Now, continue with the story from where we left off just before. But after Xerxes' anger had subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what she had done and the decree he had made. So his personal attendant suggested, "Let us search the empire to find beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint agents in each province to bring these beautiful young women to the royal harem in the fortress of Susa. Haggai, the king's eunuch in charge of the harem, will see that they are all given beauty treatments. After that, the young woman who most pleases the king will be made queen instead of Vashti." This advice was very appealing to the king, so he put the plan into effect. At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and was a descendant of Kish and Shimei. His family had been among those who, with King Jehoiakim of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This man had a very beautiful and lovely young cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. As a result of the king's decree, Esther, along with many other young women, was brought to the king's harem at the fortress of Susa and placed in Haggai's care. Haggai was very impressed with Esther and treated her kindly. He quickly ordered a special menu for her and provided her with beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids, specially chosen from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background, because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. Every day, Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what's happening to her. Before each young woman was taken to the king's bed, she was given the prescribed 12 months of beauty treatments, 6 months with oil of myrrh, followed by 6 months with special perfumes and ointments. When it was time for her to go to the king's palace, she was given her choice of whatever clothing or jewelry she wanted to take from the harem. That evening, she was taken to the king's private rooms, and the next morning, she was brought to the second harem, where the king's wives lived. There, she would be under the care of Shahrazad, the king's eunuch in charge of the concubines. She would never go to the king again unless he had especially enjoyed her and requested her by name. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, who was Mordecai's uncle. Mordecai had adopted his younger cousin Esther. When it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of Haggai, the eunuch in charge of the harem. She asked for nothing except what he suggested, and she was admired by everyone who saw her. Esther was taken to King Xerxes at the royal palace in the early winter of the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than any of the other young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all his nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the provinces and giving generous gifts to everyone. Even after all the young women had been transferred to the second harem and Mordecai had become a palace official, Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality a secret. She was still following Mordecai's directions, just as she did when she lived in his home. One day, as Mordecai was on duty at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthana and Teresh, who were guards at the door of the king's private quarters, became angry at King Xerxes and plotted to assassinate him. But Mordecai heard about the plot and gave the information to Queen Esther. She then told the king about it and gave Mordecai credit for the report. When an investigation was made and Mordecai's story was found to be true, the two men were impaled on a sharp pole, and this was all recorded in the book of the history of King Xerxes' reign. Well, what are we going to make of all that? Well, it's a story of power and of weakness. You see, so often in this world, feels like we just can't see God at work. You know, there's plenty of times when it'd be possible maybe for us to start questioning within ourselves whether God really is at work in this world, because everything just seems to carry on without him. But more than that, perhaps many things carry on deliberately disregarding him or opposing him. So, you know, in governments in places like China, Vietnam, the Arabian Peninsula, just to name one or two, actively oppress the church. And in the West, and our troubles aren't a patch on that, are they? But maybe there's times when you face a power that you don't feel you can stand up to. You feel pressured, perhaps, into doing something dishonest at work. Or you're expected to comply with an ideology that you just can't accept as a Christian. You're fearful of the consequences of not going along with it. I well remember when I was at school, and we were studying the history of the Islamic Empire. And we were told that whenever we wrote the name of the Prophet Muhammad, that we had to write the letters PBUH after his name. Because that's what the Muslims do as a gesture of respect. It means peace and blessings upon him. And I well remember my fear as I approached my history teacher after the class to say I just couldn't do that. Because boy, did that man have a temper. It may simply be that you feel powerless and pathetic in the face of the mockery of friends and family. For whatever reason, maybe they think it's foolish and naive of you that you don't, I don't know, tweak your tax return or cheat on your expenses because, well, you've got to work the system, you've got to get whatever you can. Maybe it's just that your faith is foolish to them. Makes them shake their heads in disbelief whenever they look at you. They're the ones who despise all that Jesus Christ stands for, and yet perhaps they're the ones that seem to have happy, successful lives. Where is God at times like those? At times when all the power and the success seems to belong to those who despise him. They're the ones who seem to get to the top of the pile. Well, into those kind of situations, the book of Esther speaks very powerfully. You see, it's a book that has disturbed many, both Jewish and Christian readers, over the years, because it's a book that never mentions God once. So it's unique in the whole of the Bible. It never mentions God. It never mentions any kind of religious practice other than a very brief mention of fasting. It's almost like it's a totally secular book, it seems. But actually, that's part of the book's power. It's often said that your good stories show rather than tell. You don't want a story to preach at you. I'm preaching now. My job is to tell you things, to explain things to you. But stories show us. C.S. Lewis always replied to all the letters he got from fans around the world. And one young fan sent him a story wanting feedback, and when he replied, he says his feedback to her was this. He said, look, don't tell me that it was delightful, a delightful morning, whatever it was, he said, but rather describe it in such a way that I read it and say, well, that's delightful. That's how stories work. They never tell us, but we can see what's going on. And so this is a story that makes us want to say, you know, even when we can't see him, even when there aren't signs in the sky, even when there aren't great miracles going on, look at how God is at work in all the little details and seeming coincidences of life. And he does that without even mentioning his name. It's a great story. Let me encourage you to read right through it. It's only 10 chapters. It won't take you very long, especially if you don't know the story, because it is a really great story. And as you read through it, watch out for the many reversals that take place. That's one thing that happens a lot in Esther. Who's feasting and who's mourning? Who's in favour and who has lost favour? Who's up, who's down? And look out as well for the many little coincidences. Things that just happen to be so for the story to turn out all right. In fact, the whole story hinges not on the heroism of the characters. The whole story hinges on the fact that everything changes when one night the king can't sleep. And so he commands his servant to read him a bedtime story. And that's the changing point in the story. It's full of just so coincidences like that. Anyway, my task just for this morning really is to set the stage. That's what chapters 1 and 2 do for us. They set the stage where this story is going to play out. And it's a stage that is set with overwhelming power and might on one side and very real weakness, vulnerability on the other. And so, in that sense, on all kinds of levels, it bears lots of similarities to the world today, in big ways and small. So let's look first of all then at the power of the world in chapter 1, then just the beginning of chapter 2 there. The year is 483 BC. May not be a year that you remember exactly what happened, but let me tell you, where does that place us in the story of the Bible first of all? That lands us in the gap of several decades that we... In the book of Ezra, you remember we looked at the book of Ezra last year, and you may remember there's two parts. So in chapters 1 to 6, the first bunch of exiles return from Babylon and rebuild the temple. Then you've got a gap of several decades before Ezra himself returns to teach the people. We're in that gap now. But we are very far from the promised land. We're very far from that group of returned exiles. In fact, we've got even further away. We're not in Babylon anymore. We are 200 miles further east in Susa, down here, there's Babylon. Okay, Babylon round to Jerusalem would have been a journey of about 800 miles, and we've gone a further 200 miles further east. The king is the Greek translation of his name used here in our Bible translation is Xerxes. That's the name which is better known in history. If you have a different translation, it may use the Hebrew translation of his name, which is Ahasuerus. He's the king who is well known to readers of history because his exploits attempting to invade the Greek Empire were documented by the Greek historian Herodotus. If you've seen the film 300, that's the story of some of those events, his unsuccessful attempt to conquer the Greeks. So the Persians by this stage have come in, they have conquered this Babylonian Empire, the red bit on that map. You may remember the stories of Daniel, Belshazzar's feast with the miraculous writing on the wall. At the end of that story, that night, Belshazzar the king is slain and Cyrus the Persian becomes king in his place. He was the king who allowed the exiles to return in the book of Ezra. Now, in 483 BC, Xerxes is king, and what we know from Herodotus that what he does in this year is he calls a great war council in Susa and brings the leaders from across this whole empire. It's vast, isn't it? Described in chapter 1 verse 1 as stretching from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces. So he calls this great war council, and that's the feast in chapter 1, lasting 180 days. So because he rules over this vast, incredibly diverse empire, it's a great strategy, isn't it, for trying to win the loyalty of the leaders of all these provinces that naturally would have their own agendas that wouldn't necessarily align with his plans for power. And so he makes this wildly lavish affair because he wants to impress on them just how capable he is to give to his faithful followers whatever he wants. Such is the extent of his power, he can give them anything. And that's why this feast is so vast and so lavish. Now, on the face of it, all that stuff is the important stuff of world history. That's the stuff of the history books, the importance of the Greeks to world history, and the attempt by the Persians to take them over, hugely important. But actually, in the book of Esther, that's just a bit of background. here in the book of Esther, the focus is on the fate of this beleaguered minority in the face of the massive power of this mighty empire. And that's, of course, the Jews, this beleaguered minority. These are the events that actually the inspired author thinks are far more important for us to focus on. So you have this wildly lavish feast. Do you notice all the details we were given in verses 3 to 9 of chapter 1? Counts as 180 days long, displaying, verse 4, the opulent wealth of his empire and the pomp and splendor of Xerxes' majesty. Then this incredibly detailed description of the second banquet, which is the whole population of Susa, where the king's generosity knows no bounds. The people invited into the stunningly fabulous courtyard garden by the palace. It's the picture of a king of an empire that has everything. This is what real power looks like. And when we see things like that described to us, there's a certain element of it that's attractive to us, isn't there? Perhaps that's one thing why things like the Forbes rich list can be so fascinating. Why do we need a list of who's richest? We notice the language there is interesting, isn't it? Today's winners and losers. Here's how you get power. Here's what real power and influence looks like. We want to know who's attained that kind of success. We can very easily begin to long for that kind of influence ourselves. We don't expect to get up to their level, but in our own little ways. But there's something else you need to know, and that's that when you pursue power like that, normally everything else and everyone else will be ultimately disposable if they get in your way. It's easy to see in business, say, those who are the richest and most powerful people in the world generally have a trail of wreckage in their wake, don't they? Competitors forced out of business, employees forced to work in poor conditions or for meagre pay, who see none of the vast profits that's created by their labour. And all the while, these businesses seem to manage to avoid paying the same taxes as everyone else. And yet these are the leaders, the people who seem to end up on the top of the pile, the people with the most wealth and power. Now, for Xerxes, it looked quite different because he wasn't in business, but it's the same principle. He could take and he could get rid of whatever he wanted. So in his case, on the final day of feasting, he calls for Vashti, his queen. She was to come in all her finest royal attire. You see, she was an exquisite beauty. And so he wanted to show her off to all the people he's trying to oppress, along with all his other treasures. For reasons that we're not told, Queen Vashti disobeys the king's order. She will not come. She ain't coming. It's one of these little moments that makes us smile. It was kind of good to hear one of you all chuckling at odd moments as we read through the story. This book of Esther should make us do that. It wants to make us laugh at some of the pretensions of power that thinks itself independent of God. This ungodly power. The wonderful moment, isn't it? Here's King Xerxes, and he may rule the whole known world, but he can't get the missus to do what he says. But of course, the flip side of that is that when so much of your power and your prestige rests on your image of uncontested power, then you've got a problem. And so Xerxes and his top advisors managed to make this little domestic spat into an international incident. Which is quite an achievement, isn't it? Vashti simply must be got rid of. She is ultimately disposable. She gets in the way of the king's desire for power. And women across the empire are to be ordered not to get any ideas in their heads. Maybe Memucan and all his other advisors were getting worried about what they would get when they got home. You see a similar disregard in the policy of chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. When Xerxes feels the need of a replacement queen, well, they simply organize an empire-wide beauty contest. But you see, again, we don't know whether the girls had a choice. But, again, unless the king asked again for a girl by name, she would spend the rest of her life in the royal harem. She would never be allowed home to her friends and family. She'd been with the king. That marked her out. She could never be a part of ordinary life again. So you see, we have this situation where those in power can simply use whoever they want and whatever they want to achieve the ends they desire. And that's sometimes a bit like what it feels like for us, isn't it? You may find smaller situations, bigger situations, where it feels a little like that. What can you do in the face of such power? Well, the second thing we're shown in this, as we set the stage for the book of Esther, is, in the rest of chapter 2, the weakness of God's people. We're faced here with a world power that can do what it wants and take whatever it wants and do whatever it wants to whoever it wants. And in such a world, God's people look pretty weak and vulnerable. And maybe you feel like that at times. Actually, it reminds us of what the Bible has always taught. It's always taught that actually, as followers of Jesus, we live as exiles in this world. We're exiles in a very important sense because we are members of a different kingdom that marches to a different drumbeat. Just as God's people here were exiles in the Persian Empire. None of the people that we meet are great or important. Esther, we meet as an orphan. We meet her cousin, her guardian, Mordecai. They're hundreds of miles from their home. And because of that too, it's an interesting little detail in verse 7. So they very often felt like they were perhaps pulled in two directions. It was like they had a split identity. Isn't it interesting, in verse 7, we're told Esther's Hebrew name, Hadassah, and her Persian name, Esther, a name which comes from Ishtar, who's a Babylonian goddess of love and war. It's almost like she has this split identity. And she has to live with that tension, knowing that she's a member of God's people, and yet, as we'll see more and more as the story unfolds, forced to live in this radically pagan context. Perhaps there's times when she felt maybe she just had to have a split personality just to get by. Let me just pause at this moment really to note and to say this is how we are not going to come to the book of Esther. We are not primarily looking for Esther to be a good example for us. That's not how we're supposed to read this book. It's how we very naturally read stories in the Bible. Well, who's the good example? Who's the bad example? And that can be helpful in a limited way, so long as we're very, very careful. But it really doesn't work in the book of Esther, though many people have tried to. I came across a blog post advertising a series of Bible studies designed for teenage girls to use, using Esther as a role model. Well, hang on. How did Esther gain power and influence? She won a beauty contest. And she had to spend a night with the king, which was not an invitation for tea and cakes, was it? That is hardly the role model we're looking for. Now, we simply do not know what's going on inside Esther's head. The writer doesn't tell us. Maybe she made terrible compromises to get where she got. Maybe she was simply so coerced that she had no option. We just don't know. I'll be honest, I cannot work out how she could have done what she did without seriously compromising her obedience to God's law as a faithful Jew. But the writer just doesn't tell us about those things, and that's important. It tells us that that's not what he's interested in. Okay, if it was really important, he would have told us. All the stories that try to make Esther into a good example for us, or indeed a bad example for us, have to make all kinds of assumptions. Well, I think this must have been what was going on then. That's fine, but the Bible doesn't tell us. You just change your assumptions, you change the outcome. So it's really important that we notice that the writer doesn't tell us about that. He doesn't want us to think about Esther like that. And that's, you see, why we're calling this series When God is Unseen, rather than, you know, Esther, Woman of God, or something like that. Because that more accurately reflects what the writer of Esther is interested in showing us. By the way, I do just hope that that little detail encourages you. If you're in a place where you feel like you've allowed yourself to become terribly compromised in your Christian witness, because God still used Esther. So what does the writer want to show us? Well, what he does seem to highlight again and again in this chapter is just how vulnerable her position was. You see, she's an orphan. She's an exile. It's very interesting, verse 8, it doesn't say that Esther went to the king's harem, but that she was brought to the king's harem. It's a choice of words, doesn't it? It implies that somebody else did the bringing. She was someone who was kind of swept along in this course of events. I somehow doubt that when Esther entered the harem, she signed a consent form, like we seem to have to do in so many activities or things that happen to us these days. She was someone swept along by events. Yet by virtue of her beauty, this is where she ended up. And she has to live here in the harem. Okay, incredible luxury, all the finery that money could buy, but she is totally cut off from everyone she had known before. No contact with friends, family, the outside world. We understand that she and Mordecai exchanged messages, but always through intermediaries. She could never have met him. She has to live like this for a whole year, preparing for this one night with the king. And when the time comes, she goes into the king's bedroom. Whole future riding on how she performed that night. Is she going to spend the rest of her life in this sort of luxurious desolation of the king's harem? Kept apart from the rest of the world. Or would something radically different happen? Well, verse 17. Can you imagine this unfolding before your eyes? Beyond her wildest dreams? I don't know. The king loved Esther, verse 17, more than any of the other young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all his nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the provinces and giving generous gifts to everyone. Who would have dreamt it? There's more feasting in Xerxes' palace, but this time it's to honor Esther as his new queen. Well, great, she's made it, hasn't she? Well, let's still be careful, because before we start imagining this as some sort of fairy tale wedding where the humble common girl catches Prince Charming's eye, well, I think the word love there is in the most generic sense. It's rather overstating the case, isn't it? And what we could really attribute to Xerxes' feelings. And then we're immediately reminded in verse 20 of what we first learned back in verse 10, that Mordecai had warned Esther not to reveal her Jewish identity. Again, we don't know why, we're not told. Maybe he sent some sort of anti-Semitism in the Persian court. He sent some sort of danger, some sort of problem here. You see, this isn't some sort of fairy tale match made in heaven where the king simply loves Esther for who she is. No, no, she's still incredibly vulnerable. She's still carrying this secret. Still, she could be exposed and she could suffer such a fall as Vashti's at any time. This isn't a fairy tale ending. Even when Mordecai gains some prominence, he becomes a royal official and he exposes this assassination plot at the end of the chapter. The assassination plot of Bigthan and Teresh, who want to kill the king. Well, he's overlooked. He receives no rewards. So just store that incident away for later on in the story. Okay? This is how the people that God has promised to keep and to save are introduced to us in the book of Esther. It doesn't look like a particularly promising picture, does it? His weakness, his vulnerability in the face of this overwhelming power. It looks like all the odds were stacked against them. And maybe you feel like that in your walk as a Christian sometimes too. Maybe there's times when you feel like you need to have this sort of split identity, like Esther. Maybe it feels in certain social situations too risky to reveal your true identity as a follower of Christ. Maybe you feel very vulnerable in a work situation where those in power despise your Christian convictions. Well, if that's you, take heart from the story of Esther. It has ever been thus. Ever been thus. But always in such a way that God is at work through the weakness and through the vulnerability. That is the way that God has always worked. It's the God whose work is going to climax in the ultimate act of weakness as an innocent victim of Roman might is executed on a cross. No one was standing around that cross saying, "Wow, look at that. Look at what God's doing. Isn't that incredible?" They only saw utter failure. But from that event, God brought about Jesus' resurrection in power in order to reign over a kingdom that will never end, a kingdom that will last long after the mightiest of mighty world empires has crumbled into ruins. This is the way that God works. And that's the trajectory that we're on through the story of Esther. We've only set the scene in this chapter. But notice already how there's all those things that just happen to be so. That out of all the most beautiful virgins in the empire, it was Esther who happened to catch the king's eye. And of all the many people who passed through the king's gates, it happened to be Mordecai who overheard the plot against the king. You see, throughout this book, we will see the hand of the unseen God at work. There will be no miracles, but we will see the hand of God at work. And I hope it's still the same today. There's a Bible scholar called Karen Jobes who's done some really written some really good stuff on Esther, and this is how she sums it up. Like Xerxes of long ago, modern kings, presidents, and rulers make decisions from purely political motives. Like Vashti, people today unwittingly make decisions that have long-reaching consequences far beyond what they could have foreseen. These events may be completely secular, and perhaps made by people who give Christ no thoughts. Nonetheless, through them, God is moving all of history forward to accomplish all that must happen before the return of his Son, Jesus Christ, the true King of Kings. That is how our God is at work. It isn't simply weakness against power, but his power in our weakness. That is our hope, and that is the encouragement we will take in the book of Esther. Let's take a moment to respond to God's word individually, and then we'll sing our final hymn.